Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, my name's Nick.
Hello, I'm Woogie.
We are the Mouth of Manliness. This is a podcast all about mental health. But it's not just mental health. It's kind of about people's lives and about how they cope and how they manage in the world.
Yeah, and digging into the stories that make them who they are.
Yeah, so it's real life stories where we talk about things that people have been through and how they've managed and how they've coped and how they've come out the other side. So sometimes it's just me and Woogie here, but more often than not, we're talking to guests, sometimes more well-known guests, but more often than anything, it's just normal people who have been through interesting situations.
Yeah, and they've all got a lovely story to tell.
Yeah, so Mouth of Manliness, we are about mental health, but we're more about people and stories.
So, welcome to the Mouth.
The Mouth of Manliness. Welcome back, everyone, to the Mouth of Manliness. We are still, season three, all going very well. I want to do a shout out to Tramp Man and to Nikon Knights. I've got a really exciting guest today from America. Dr. Meg Van Dousen.
Yeah, we actually pronounce it Van Dusen up here.
Van Dusen. That sounds loads better.
Well, you know, it's Dutch. It should be Van Dusen, but, you know, we see Van Dusen, yeah.
Ah, nice. So, thank you. Thank you for coming on the show. Where are you?
Yeah, I'm in Seattle, Washington.
Ah, lovely. Yeah, I'm a 90s kid, so, I grew up in the 90s, so I was always excited about Seattle.
Oh, cool.
Vans, yeah, defo. So what are you a doctor in, Meg?
Yeah, so I am a clinical psychologist. I've got a private practice, and I just authored the book Stressed in the U.S.
Amazing. So tell us about the book. Let's start with that.
Yeah, you know, I was noticing, this is prior to the pandemic, I want to make that clear. Yeah. You know, I was just noticing that the things that people were coming into the therapy room with people weren't just talking about their personal stress. That's always been the case. But they were starting to talk about other stressors like mass shootings, politics, global warming, and anxiety was really rising among people in my private practice, as was insomnia. And so I really started to take a look at what was happening in our country. And our country is not unlike many countries around the world. There are a lot of parallels with the UK. You know, loneliness levels were dramatically rising here. And so I started to look at all the pieces of the puzzle. You know, social media, tech use, what was happening in our country in terms of political divide, and national events such as 9/11, and how all of these things seemed to be coalescing with what I was seeing in my practice, which was a rise in anxiety, a sense of chronic dis-ease, if you will. Yeah. And that because I practice from a depth-oriented model, I look at people's relationships with each other and the security of those relationships based on what their family of origin was like. And I started to make links between this concept of secure attachment and stress.
Oh, yeah.
I started to really realize that we had, you know, two major phenomenons happening here, that the security of our relationships with each other was decreasing dramatically. And that's a huge buffer against stress.
Yeah.
And our stress levels were rising dramatically. So that's what prompted me to write the book. And then the pandemic hit and stress really flew off the charts.
Yeah.
So, you know, I hope people can find something that is pertinent to them, but it does address a lot of different aspects of stress, you know.
It's amazing what you say. From my own kind of knowledge, like we talk a lot about attachment and, you know, people having, you know, attachment issues or sometimes when you're talking to someone, you get this idea, you know, when you start talking about their, like their backgrounds and you get this idea that, yeah, there's not a secure attachment and it makes, and then a lot of behavior starts to make sense. And yeah,
it's a great theory. It's well researched and it does make a lot of sense. Yeah.
Oh, it totally makes sense. But then if you put that into context of like as you were saying, like 9/11 or you know, a big scary incident, if you haven't got that attachment base there already, then you know everything's gonna make you more scared, isn't it? And the media is just built up to make us scared.
Yeah, for sure. Especially here with mass shootings, you know, that's just been a huge thing here. It's, you know, when the stress surveys that the American Psychological Association does every year were done in, I think it was 2018, they really looked at the Z generation and found that, you know, 75% of them were worried about mass shootings. It's a significant source of stress for young people in particular. But the other thing about attachment that I think is really fascinating is that we don't just, I mean, so attachment is essentially the psychological bond between two people.
Yeah.
And it really originates from the initial bond that a baby makes with its caregiver, usually the parent. Yeah. And then that translates in adulthood to how you navigate your relationships. And it's based on whether that parent gave you attuned responses or not. But what I found is we can also have attachments to our nation or to other groups, you know, schools, workplaces. And those can be insecure or secure as well. And it really became apparent to me from my private practice that the security of our attachment to our nation here in the US was declining, you know, quite a lot. Really, I started looking at it after 9/11, but there's so many things that went into that and why it was declining here. So even if people had a secure attachment, you're right, they should be able to navigate stress better. If their attachment to their nation was breaking down, saw increases in anxiety.
That's such a that's a really strange concept to me. The idea of like being secure with your nation.
And yeah, well, you think about it like, you know, we say the father of our nation or the motherland. We personify countries as parental figures.
And so
whoever is leading the countries, you know, we had Trump here and that wasn't making people, a lot of people feel very secure, with high anxiety for 4 years. And, you know, whatever is happening in the nation, if, you know, there's a terrorist attack, all of a sudden you feel like, gosh, my country doesn't feel that secure anymore. I'm walking through the airport and I can't just waltz on through anymore to my plane. It creates sort of this less conscious, maybe, but generalized feeling of not feeling safe and secure. Helps us feel safe, you know?
Yeah, it's very true. Yeah, and it makes complete sense. I like
psychology is it's a very interesting topic because quite often it's telling you something that makes sense, and it's like, oh yeah, I should know that.
Yeah, it can be really validating, right?
Yeah. I did a degree in criminal justice, and like a large part of that was psychology. And my wife did a degree in psychology as well. So it's kind of it's something that comes up a lot. And it's just so amazing. Like, I've had quite a bit of therapy through the years, and often they are those little concepts, and you're like, ah, right.
Yeah.
I can navigate now. I can.
Yep.
it's really interesting, especially you say about security. Everything's security. You wonder how people cope in, the really war-torn areas, like in Eastern Europe years ago. And you wonder how it must impact on them, because they're directly at threat. But I tell the truth, you talk about shootings, in schools and things. It's not going to be, they're up there, aren't they?
Well, no, you're right. I mean, there are massive groups of people. I mean, I'm just thinking about India right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, my God, what they're going through. But yeah, there have been, points in history where the stress has been off the charts and the trust in the country is completely obliterated. This is not new. But I think for the U.S., it feels kind of new. Not that we haven't had our own tragedies, but, we've sort of had this illusion of protection that really doesn't exist as much anymore.
Yeah. Oh, I can imagine. Oh, like in the 80s, when I grew up, we were looking to America, whenever I played, I always played an American accent, it was Star Wars and everything. And at times like that, you're going to feel pretty, pretty strong. It makes sense. It really does.
But and a then lot
you've
of
got
this
that
stuff
turned around.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these phenomena, like the loneliness epidemic here, is also true for the UK. And a lot of what we're seeing in terms of breakdown of attachment, unfortunately, seems to correlate with social media and tech use. It's just a fact. And that's worldwide. I do address that, social media and tech is here to stay, and it's not all bad, obviously. Yeah. But it definitely was something that, like many addictive things such as cigarettes, we just didn't think about it until it was, wreaking havoc. And the dark side took over, and we had figure out how to, set boundaries around it. And it's a pretty powerful thing, in terms of its effect on kids, ability to develop empathy, in terms of loneliness, depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation. It's a huge part of stress these days. And I think something that we just really need to figure out how to deal with in a better way.
So what in particular, what are the particular issues that you feel about it?
Well, most teens spend about 9 hours a day on an electronic device. What the research shows is that if people are spending more than 2 hours a day on an electronic device, their scores on cognitive tests and language learning go down. Rates of depression are higher. So kids, even who spend more than 2 hours a day, which I'm sorry, I don't know a kid that doesn't spend less than 2 hours a day on a bus. I think they all do. Are less happy.
Why do you think that is then? I've got fairly young children. Like, I've got a daughter who's 14 and my son's 11. I can't really, my son's got autism, so I can't really judge it on him. But I would say if I judged it on my daughter, she's mostly watching TV or a film. That's the thing. She's not necessarily...
good for her, because most kids are on social media.
Oh, she doesn't actually, she doesn't seem that bothered with social media. But, you know, with lockdown, it's been quite useful because she's been able to talk to her friends a bit and they tend to type on WhatsApp. But, yeah, and then I just think, well, what, yeah, if she's just watching TV or a film, that's pretty much what I did.
That screen media does come into play. It is a screen.
They do say that, yeah, the screen in particular.
But what really I think we're looking at here is, you know, the doom scrolling, right? The devices, the eye devices that actually, and particularly the smartphone, that make it so easy to become addicted to just scrolling, switching, clicking, doing whatever. You're not going to do that when you're watching a film.
No, that's true. That's true.
And the social media influence is major on kids in terms of, I mean, the research is so plentiful now with regard to the fact that it just makes people feel poorly about themselves majority of the time. And I'm not saying all the time.
I'm not saying
it's all bad, but really when you look at what are the benefits to, you know, what are the drawbacks are so much more. You know, it just is what it is. And particularly, you know, and you see that in films like The Social Dilemma or Race to Nowhere or, you know, other films that have been done about, you know, tech use and its effect on kids in that, you know, the recent study out of the National Institute of Health here, you know, is looking at gray matter in the brain and that it reduces gray matter in the brain, which is really responsible for our executive functions like organizing and, you know, figuring out, you know, how to critically think. So it is a pretty big deal. And because it's something that sort of crept up, I mean, the iPhone came out in 2007. It's not been, you know, it's sort of been like the frog in the water, right? It's not been as easy to notice on a daily basis, but teen suicide has gone up 60%.
Between 60%
between 2007 and 2018. And
really?
2007 is when the iPhone came out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No way. Do you think there's an element of it that you're very disconnected and separate while you're doing it? So you're not aware of the beauty of the sky. You know, you're just there. And that brings your vision right in. And then if you think, you know, everyone in the house is kind of doing that, then you're also missing out on interaction and attachment. And then is that, because I start thinking about where's the loneliness come in. And I think if you end up just doing that all the time, you're not engaging with other people and that will make you feel lonely.
Absolutely. It's correlated with loneliness completely. I mean, half of millennials report that they do not feel, you know, connected at all to their family, even when they're in the room with them. And that's with the presence of, you know, smartphones.
So it's a
huge thing with regard to secure attachment, because remember that the origin of creating secure attachment, it's a neurobiological, psychological process where the baby is looking at the mother, let's say, and the mother's eyes are dilating because of the love she feels for the baby. The baby's responding to that eye dilation. And so really the mother's verbal and nonverbal communication is imprinting on the baby's right hemisphere, helping to grow the brain, helping to develop emotion regulation, self-regulation, all of those things that are important for life. that continues. I mean, you know, when we look each other in the eye, we get oxytocin release and we're more likely to want to be with each other. We're more likely to want to hang out with each other.
Yeah.
You just can't get that with texting, Snapchat, and social media exchanges. It doesn't exist. And, you know, not to mention that, especially among teens, the persona is the big thing. You can tweak your photos, you can make yourself, you can, you know, it's not often very authentic, particularly in that age group. So it really is giving kids kind of a false understanding of connection and really ripping them off from connection. There's a reason why teenagers are not having sex as much as they did in the prior generations.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
They don't get together. They're not going out on dates. And, you know, some parents might be happy about that, but really what it points to is a sad phenomenon. It comes down to the fact that they're not physically getting together as much. They're in the bedrooms. And so while I feel strongly about this, and I've got two sons, one's 20, one's 16. And so they've grown up with this. And I've been in the midst of, you know, figuring out how to, you know, help them regulate it while understanding that this is the world. I mean, we're not going to be removing devices. You know, it is really, I think, one of our biggest challenges these days. So that's why tech addiction is included in a book on stress, right?
Well, it makes, of course, there's no doubt that social media gives us stress. I mean, even I do it, you know, like when you think, oh, someone's got more likes, you know, it just make all of these things just condensed into a thing that you hold that tells you you're not good enough. It's like, really helpful. And then, you know, so to some extent, I kind of impose my own rules so that I don't get, so that I, it, that the phone doesn't make me feel bad, you know? And
you have to impose your own rules. Yeah. But what's hard about it is it's, you know, unlike, you know, maybe, and I'm not saying that being an alcoholic is easy, but, you know, you can remove the booze from the house.
Yeah.
You cannot do that with your smartphone. At least it's very difficult to function day-to-day life if you do that. And so now they're, you know, they're, you're finding these camps popping up that are, you know, they're not really camps. They're treatment programs for kids who are addicted to their devices. So there are no devices allowed, obviously, in the treatment programs out in the middle of nowhere in nature to get them unhooked.
God, I wonder how long they have to go for. Yeah. I wonder how long that takes. And, like, do you... You wouldn't have withdrawals, would you? Not physical withdrawals.
Well, that's... There... I mean, there is a form of withdrawal that occurs. I mean, kids really get anxious. I mean, so there are studies done on this. When people are separated from their smartphones, this isn't just kids, this is people like you and me too, are separated from their smartphones, their anxiety levels go up.
Oh, I agree. If I go outside to smoke a cigarette and I don't take my phone, it's like, oh, I'll have to go back in.
Yeah,
let's go and get it, because like what am I really going to do while I'm doing it?
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, we do have to find ways to, you know, regulate it. And I think, you know, restriction is really hard in general, or willpower, so to speak, is difficult. And so one of the things that I talk about is actually not... I mean, I do talk about boundaries and, you know, whether it be place boundaries, not having it in the bedroom, not having it in the front seat of the car, you know, things like that. But really, I think what needs to happen, and certainly what we've done with our 16-year-old, is just require that you have to spend a certain amount of time outside without your device, or you've got to spend a certain amount of time doing something physically active without the device.
Oh, rather. Right,
other activities that don't entail the device.
But what you're also not saying is no device.
Right. Well, it's not so focused on...
Not saying you're only allowed 2 hours. You put a different spin on it. Yeah, clever. I like that.
The only allowed 2 hours is a tough one. I mean, you can't. Mm. It's so hard to regulate that with teenagers.
What are some of your stress ideas about kind of dealing with stress? I meditate, and that sorts me out pretty quickly. Half an hour, and I feel much more together.
Yeah. Meditation, I talk about that. I dedicated a chapter to mindfulness. And the reason being is that the research on it is, once again, abundant and, really sort of earth-shattering, in that mindfulness, which isn't necessarily meditation, it's just paying attention in the present moment without judgment. So you can be mindful. I can be mindful right now while I'm talking to you, and not be meditating. And that practice of being fully present without judgment really does all kinds of positive things for the body, the brain, the psyche. It decreases anxiety, it decreases depression, it lowers blood pressure, it decreases cortisol in the body, it sharpens cognition. So I can't say enough about it. And a lot of people shy away from it because they feel like it's meditation. It's like, I don't have time for that. I can't be sitting down 30 minutes a day. I talk about all of that in the book. There are ways that you can incorporate mindful practice without having to sit down and meditate for 30 minutes a day, although that's a really good thing to do.
I mean, that does help. I do mindfulness quite a bit as well. I was having kind of like a loose CBT type therapy, but also a lot of talking as well. And this was probably about 4 years ago, and the therapist was great, and then he started to introduce mindfulness to me just a little bit at a time. It totally works. It's one of those things where, as you say, you don't have to be doing a lot, just paying attention without judgment. You know, it brings you in a bit. I swear by it. And it's not complicated. It is really quite simple, as you say, but it makes a massive, and then you start to appreciate things more.
So the other thing about mindfulness that's so key here is that, like you and I talked about earlier, if you have a secure attachment, and there are a host of different kinds of insecure attachments, by the way, but if you have a secure attachment, you really are developing the same traits that mindfulness practice promotes. So mindfulness practice and secure attachment have a lot in common. And in fact, you know, if you've grown up, you know, with, traumatic childhood, or you didn't have a secure attachment with your caregiver because your caregiver was self-absorbed or whatnot, it doesn't mean that's set in stone. You can change your attachment style. And, you know, you don't have to be in a fantastic relationship with a romantic partner or have a best friend or anything to do that. You can actually affect your attachment style by practicing mindfulness meditation, because you're developing a non-judgmental, compassionate relationship with the self when you do that. And that is the basis. It's attunement, compassionate, non-judgmental. All of those things are the basis of what helps develop secure attachment. So it's really key. It's a key thing here for people to do. I mean, I was just talking with one of my, you know, patients the other day who, again, was running into the time problem. And we just discussed the idea of setting reminders. Here's where we have to use the smartphone sometimes, but for the better good, setting reminders on the phone so that he will pause three times throughout the day for 5 minutes and just focus on his breathing. Just to kind of press the reset button, you know, and begin to develop a non-judgmental, you know, moment with himself. This is somebody who's very critical of himself. So just starting to practice that, it just has, it seems so simple, but it really has, you know, far-reaching effects that are great and that help reduce stress.
I think it's something you have to do quite regularly. You have to try and get into a habit.
Right.
You do it quite regularly. And after a while, you find yourself doing it normally. Like anything, you know, all those things, they take a little while, but you put the effort in early, then it will pay off later. And
I tell people to start small, because if you make the goal that you're going to meditate for 30 minutes a day and you're going from zero, it's kind of like going from zero to 60. Yeah. You're probably going to fall off the wagon. But if you start small, like, I'm just going to do this for 5 minutes, I'm going to build it up, you're more likely to be successful with it.
I had the best. I used to see a hypnotherapist not that long ago, and it was amazing. But we would spend about an hour prior to basically doing talking therapy and just throwing ideas around, and it just really worked. But he, I was really low one day, and he said he did like a trick with me to where you pick everything bad is one colour and everything good that you want is another colour. So I was like, yellow's bad. And then I close my eyes, really focus on it. And then really close my eyes and focus on blue. And I find that when I'm feeling really, like my head's just going in on itself, I'll notice something blue. And then that will go, ah, right, notice the blues.
Yeah, you know, right.
It really works, because it somehow it popped in now. And that brings me back to mindfulness every time I start feeling stressed. It's amazing. These things, they do work.
It's Rick Hansen, who is another psychologist here in the U.S. It's his whole concept. He wrote the book Hardwiring Happiness about looking for the good. That's what you're doing there.
Yeah.
You know, it's looking for the good, because our minds are wired to look for the threats.
Yeah.
And if you're suffering from chronic stress, you're in a feedback loop where you're constantly looking for the threats. Yeah. And this is the problem with loneliness too, is that lonely people perceive other people as threatening, because it's about rejection or not feeling enough. And so it's a really difficult cycle to break with loneliness. Actually, one of the best ways to break it is really practicing speaking kindly to yourself. It doesn't have to be about going out and volunteering and getting involved in groups and clubs and all that kind of stuff if it feels threatening to you. It's really about learning to speak compassionately, kindly, using your own name, you know, and speaking like, hey, Nick, I'm here for you. Really speaking that way to yourself. It is a well-researched practice that not only reduces stress, but decreases loneliness, which is a stress-related phenomenon.
When something's going well, I'll make sure I tell myself. You know, like, no, you're doing well. And then if something goes wrong, I'll kind of say to myself, oh, no, but you did that the other day and that's really good. So you're winning.
Good for you.
But it is silly, isn't it? But it if you're saying bad things to yourself and everything around you is bad, or the news is all doom, you know, and there's actually really bad stuff going on, it's hard to, you know, your brain just starts going that way.
Well,
it's hard to break it. You have to make an effort.
Yeah, when you're doing that, when you're speaking negatively to yourself, you're actually threatening yourself. So you don't know it, but you are setting off the stress response in yourself every time you criticize yourself. That's increasing cortisol. That's so damaging to the body, right? It creates heart disease, diabetes, all kinds of things. And it's that kind of chronic stress that so many people don't realize they're inflicting on themselves just by criticizing themselves. They think that they're somehow you know, practicing tough love, that if they criticize themselves enough, it'll be negative motivation. But it really doesn't work that way. It actually is much better to do what you're doing and to notice what you've done well. And to, I always say, be curious about mistakes. Mistakes are great. They help us learn, you know. So mindfulness and meditation is definitely a tool to reduce stress.
Good ones.
You know, a really easy one, and this is also quite profound to me, again, based on the research, is to just be in contact with nature of some sort for a few minutes every day. Mm. And I want to be clear, you know, some of the Nordic countries, some of the countries in Europe that really, you know, are big on nature walks and forest bathing and things like that, you know, have studied this and talk about how 20 minutes in a walk in the forest dramatically reduces your cortisol levels, which
is right. That's right. It's fact. It's science fact.
It's fact.
A lot of people don't know that.
No, and I just want to say, you don't have to, kind of like I said about meditation, you don't have to go walk in the forest for 20 minutes. Yes, it's good. But other studies, there was one out of Amsterdam, showed that, I mean, let's say you're living in the city and there's not a tree in sight. That's your life. You don't have access to a forest and the park might not be safe to walk in. You can sit out on your porch and look up in the sky, or according to this study out of Amsterdam, you can actually look at nature photographs or a nature video.
So here's
a good way of using the screen again.
I mean, that seems crazy, doesn't it? It's just looking at a picture of a tree will actually make you feel that.
So they study people's brains and functional MRIs and found that when people looked at nature videos, it had the same impact on the brain that mindfulness meditation has on the brain.
That's just so... It's very hard to comprehend, but I was having a conversation about the same thing the other day, and you know, I was talking to someone who knew, you know, like yourself, and they were like, "No, it's a fact."
Yeah, it's a fact, and you know, it's true that people who live in green spaces are, you know, happier. And so, while you can't always control that, you know, maybe fill your place with plants. You know, there are studies on this. It really is a thing, and it's easy to do. And you know, we're detached from our planet. That's a problem, and it's the archetypal mother. It's why we call it Mother Nature. And there really is a benefit to nature, not just on cortisol levels, but also in the fact that when we're in nature, we feel less lonely. We feel more connected. We don't have to be there with somebody. So there really is a deep psychological effect, positive effect of nature.
I often think about it's good to get a sense of perspective. So, you know, like sitting in the garden looking at the stars gives you a concept of like how small you really are. And there has been times in my life when that has made me feel bad. But now, much more now, it makes me think, well, I can do anything. You know, like, why does it matter that someone thinks that, or, if, you know, that's happened? Like, it's what it, you know, the chance of everything happening, we just let it go.
You're talking about being less self-absorbed, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like you see the bigger picture, and you're not focusing on all the little things about yourself anymore.
Yeah, you're looking out rather than looking in.
Exactly. And,
which, strangely enough, is it's funny because I often I've talked about this many times that you know, we're talking about attachment and the idea that we spend so much of our time trying to fill the void and to have attachment. And thinking that will make everything better. You know, like you kind of, you know, it's this hope that you'll fall in love and then then everything will be good. And then you're like, I know life still goes on and there's still bad bits and good bits. And often I came to the conclusion many years ago that I'd spent a lot of time doing that and then realised that now I needed to kind of look within to do that.
Yeah, that goes back to just the power of the way in which you talk to yourself. Just become aware of it. Just start by becoming aware of how you talk to yourself.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, you're talking about, you know, on the one hand, the looking up at the sky widens the lens. It's one of the tools I talk about in the book. And that's a good thing. And then we're also talking about how kind of really attuned attention to the self in a positive way also is helpful. You know, and so it depends upon, that's not self-absorption, that's just attunement, what you're talking about there. Which is again the basis of secure attachment. But I also talk about eye contact. I know it seems really simple, and you know, I have to say one of the things that definitely has helped us with the pandemic is the fact that we have had things like Zoom and the fact that you and I can look at each other. And even though the camera's a little up there, wherever it is, it's still better than talking on the phone. But people are looking down at their devices so much. That's just a fact. And are getting together less, particularly with the pandemic and probably maybe post-pandemic. That it's just key that we try to be intentional about looking each other in the eye. It creates a sense of connection. It doesn't have to be some big, long, weird staring at somebody.
No, you're right.
It's just grocery store clerk, you know, your kid, just taking the time to do it actually does increase oxytocin, which is that feel-good social hormone that's going to make you want to interact with people more and less with your phone.
And I often kind of I've kind of come to this idea that life is all about relationships and connections. And everything else is reasonably just, you know, bricks and mortar. When it's actually about connection, it's actually about talking to people, and then that makes you feel good, and then they feel good, and then someone else feels good. And just this general idea that actually, you know, relationships are so, so important. And if we are on our phones, we're not having relationships. You know, we're not having those conversations where suddenly you learn something that you didn't know, you know.
Yeah, it really is. It's the key to our well-being.
Yeah, we can't do it on our own. That's why it's really sad that. Did you think people being isolated, did that happen before? Was that still a big thing before COVID? Has that been since?
Yeah, UC San Diego did a study in 2018 on loneliness and found that 75% of Americans were moderately to highly lonely. 75%.
That's really horrible.
The thing again that I think is noteworthy is that the loneliest generation is not the oldest generation. It's the Z generation. That's our young adults and teenagers. And it does once again correlate to the culture they're growing up in. That's highly, highly digital. So loneliness, what I found in my practice is that loneliness definitely increased during the pandemic, but it was already really high. But so did social anxiety, so that as we started to open up more and people could actually, you know, go out and do some things they couldn't do months prior, there was this general tendency to kind of hang back, to feel a little kind of naked and exposed out there in the world. And people couldn't put their finger on it. You know, I had one patient say, I just feel, who used to travel all the time, I just feel sort of a little anxious getting on an airplane, not because of COVID, but just being out in the world among people, like, you know, there doesn't, really was people became less familiar with being with each other. So despite the fact that they were lonelier, they weren't, you know, chomping at the bit to get out and get together with people because the anxiety was holding them back. That's kind of the thing I'm dealing with now a lot, is trying to help people assimilate again, like go back to work because they can, you know, it's important. It's an important thing to do little by little. And maybe some things will change permanently and maybe some for the better. Maybe there will be less travel and that's not a bad thing in my mind. But it is important, I think, to get back to the office and interact with live people.
Oh, yeah. But it is, as you say, it's a gradual process. So the other weekend I saw a couple of friends on two separate occasions and it was weird. I don't think any of us had a great time like we would have before. You know, before we would have been laughing and joking, but there's still restrictions, so you're kind of on edge.
And
people thought it was going to be like this blitz, you know, spirit when everyone would be all together, but they're not, everyone's nervous. And then
it's true.
It's the same. I went back to work as well. I was in office all last week and it was, yeah, it was just strange. And I kind of had to recognise that, oh no, you're not going to love it. It's you're not used to it. It's a bit weird.
We've been under chronic stress.
Yeah.
We've been traumatized in a way.
Yeah.
And so there is some degree of post-traumatic stress that's occurring right now. And you're describing that sort of this tentativeness, vigilance, right?
Vigilance.
Developed. Yeah. Right. But there are a lot of things, you know, in terms of tips, going back to tips. I mean, there are a lot of things in the book. You know, I'm just touching on some of them. But if people aren't, you know, into meditating, although I highly recommend it, or if people aren't, you know, keen on taking 5 minutes to take a walk, you know, among some trees or something. You know, you can do some simple things that actually reduce stress, like just eat better. And I know that sounds weird, but our, you know, 70% of our immune cells are in the gut, 90% of our serotonin, which is the main mood regulating hormone, lives in our gut. And the gut's connected to the brain via the hypothalamic pituitary axis, which is the main system in the body that regulates stress, and the vagus nerve, which also regulates stress. And so what we put in our guts actually affects our brains. And there are more and more research studies on this, and now a new sort of field that's being found where some doctors are experimenting with using certain combinations of probiotics to treat depression because it's affecting gut microbiota, right? It's affecting the balance of the gut microbiome when you take certain kinds of probiotics. I wouldn't do it on your own. It's all dependent on what particularly is going on with you. But there is a ton of research now on how big a role the gut plays in psychological dis-ease. And so because these two systems, you know, that the brain and the gut are connected by the two systems that are regulating stress, if we are stressed in our head, it's going to negatively affect the gut flora, right? So regardless if you're eating, you know, the best vegan diet or whatnot, and you're still chronically stressed, you're still, you know, going to possibly imbalance your gut. Or if you're not chronically stressed in your head and you're eating, you know, crap food every day, that could really disturb the flora in the gut and it could actually create stress in the brain. So it's a fascinating link between the gut and the brain, and more research is coming out about that. And so it is something to think about.
I've often said to people, like, if I've been really, you know, really, like, badly depressed, I feel physically ill as well. You know, it's like,
I
don't feel well at all. You know, I've got no energy, but I also physically get ill constantly.
Right.
And you can see those links.
Yeah, you just, you get butterflies in your stomach even, right? When you're, yeah, you know, in a stressful event, you know, but it affects this migrating motor complex in the gut, which sweeps the bacteria from, you know, the small intestine, the large intestine, and that can break down when you're stressed, gut is clenching. And then you're messing up your gut in ways that are completely invisible. I mean, this is the thing with stress, is that all of the physical effects on the body of stress are mostly invisible. And that's why it's sort of a silent killer. I don't mean to be dramatic, but it is. And that's why I think it's so key that we really look at our lives, how we're living our lives. And I just wanted to give people some things they could do to just, you know, even adjust their life a little bit to decrease the stress so that they have happier and healthier lives, you know?
That's fantastic. It's really love. Actually, it's really nice, because a lot of the things you said are things that I kind of do or think about, and it's very validating to use the word.
Yeah, good. You're on the right track then. Yeah.
I did a course on personality disorders, and there was very much of it was about validation.
And I'm, yeah,
like, I'm like, that's so true. You know, that's
right.
Attachment too, isn't it? Validation. You wouldn't need to feel like you're okay.
Right. Yeah, and that's, you know, that's the thing. It's like, I think, unfortunately, particularly younger generations, but even adults, you know, are looking for the validation a lot via social media.
Yeah.
It's not real validation. So there's a whole phenomenon. I mean, I'm thinking about your podcast name, and there's just a whole phenomenon among young men these days around emotions again. It's like, here we are again, and really believing that if you have emotion, you're needy. And, you know, or it's just a weakness of sorts, and it couldn't be farther from the truth. And so, you know, there's sort of this phenomenon happening that's getting reinforced via social media around emotion as a weakness, and that strength is about not showing it.
Yeah, it's completely wrong, isn't it? Does not work.
And the suicide rate, you know, for young men is quite high.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's like 14 people a day in the UK, 14 men a day.
Yeah.
Which under has gone 40. Up. Yeah.
And mainly under 40, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kind of, but up towards that end, pretty much, I think. Yeah. Oh, thank you so much, Meg. I really enjoyed this. I really have.
Great talking to you, Nick.
I feel like I've learned some things. It's great.
Good.
Yeah, really fascinating. And I think everything you said is just like great advice. You know, it is these things you don't have to put loads of effort into. You know, like you can just, like sometimes when I'm walking, I'll just try and recognize like the rhythm of my footsteps, that kind of thing. And it's like bringing it in. So where do people get your book? Tell me, like, make sure we get the name in and get it all in there.
Yeah. So, you know, my book's online. You can find me on my professional website, which is just megvandusen.com. I also have a blog called Sight on Stress, S-I-G-H-T on Stress. .com, books on Amazon, you know, so it's easy to get online. And feel free to email me if you have any questions or anything else. I'm, you know, happy to help out.
Oh, thanks, Meg. I'm going to share all that stuff when we release as well, so don't worry. I'll make sure everyone knows about it. Thank you so much. What a lovely way to spend an evening.
Yeah, it was great. Morning over here.
Yeah. Yeah. Evening
for me. Take care, Meg.
Thanks
for having me.
Take care. Bye. This is the mouth.
This is the mouth. Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row?
Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.